It's Thursday, March 3rd, 2016, and you're listening to Last Time on Video Games, the show about retro video games and sometimes some other stuff. You're listening to episode 139, Phantom Train of the Opera. Runtime for this episode is 1 hour, 18 minutes.
Welcome to Last Time on Video Games, the podcast that is going to have so many final episodes. My name is Jeremy.
I survived the last one. I'm Tyler.
I'll survive the next one. My name is Zach.
Damn it. That's because you picked up the shotgun, isn't it?
Of course I don't have the shotgun. Why are you over there on the other side of the room? Come a little bit closer. I got something to show you.
Did we ever figure out how to make shotgun slugs as a group?
I know how to make them.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking about Final Fantasy VI today. One of the seminal Japanese RPGs, really the one that made them popular in the United States, and then Final Fantasy VII ran with that and made them biggest thing in the world for about 20 minutes. And then that resulted in us in getting things like Xenu Saga and Star Ocean 3. And then people were like, no, send them back from whence they came. And then we got Undertale years later. And that's the history of JRPGs.
Is Undertale really a JRPG? I mean,
I don't know, you're the one that's played it.
Yeah, I mean,
It was made by an American, but other than that, yes.
I mean, I have trouble classifying that game.
That's fair, and that's intentional. Have you seen the Earthbound hack he made before that?
Yeah, I did, actually, mostly because of the game theory. Okay.
That's what I
haven't actually watched that game theory yet, because I want to play Undertale first.
Yeah, see, I don't care, so that's why I watched it, but that's also why I haven't mentioned any of it, we've talked a little bit about Undertale.
There are a number of flaws in the theory. For example, one of the pieces of evidence he uses is there's a picture you can find. It's like, it's Sans smiling with three other people, and it's Matpat is like, the three other people are clearly the other characters from Earthbound, but, like, your character wouldn't recognize Sans with his flesh still on, and he would definitely not recognize an S, so he, she, it, Frisk.
Well, and the creator of Undertale said he was horribly embarrassed that MatPat had brought that old thing up and made people pay attention to it.
It's actually a really good port, though. I went and played it after learning about it.
I watched some of a Let's Play of it, and the fact that he can only convey horror with writing, I think he's a good horror writer. It works.
There's a couple moments in Undertale. It's kind of an optional part that you can go through. It is creepy as hell. It kind of, like, with any horror game, it diminishes after you lose once and then go and do it again. You're like, now I had to go do that part again. It's not scary anymore, it's just kind of annoying.
Well, that's the problem with that particular genre. Once you have given a face and a name to the monster, it's no longer scary.
Yeah, really, if you can help it, you should never be able to die, but that kind of takes away the consequence.
As Jeremy has put it in the past, you have to make it so that it feels like you're about to die, but never actually kill the player.
I feel like some Silent Hill moments do it pretty well.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons Silent Hill 2 is so well regarded. All right, since you've told us you've beaten Undertale, Tyler, what else have you been playing?
A little bit more Metal Gear. I finally got to the point where I can start using Quiet as my buddy.
Yay.
It's pretty awesome.
She's the best buddy. D-Dog is occasionally more useful, especially on the Save a Prisoner levels.
So D-Dog is the dog. D-Horse is the horse.
D-Walker is your mech.
And, although you can take the D-Walker regardless of whatever buddy you have, right?
No.
No?
It's your buddy. And Quiet is your sniper. She would not accept putting a D in front of her name.
So is D-Chopper your helicopter?
No, it's named after the boat in...
It's Pequod.
Pequod, yeah. It's named after the boat in, what's it called?
Moby Dick?
Yes, thank you.
Because this game has a lot of Moby Dick references?
Well, it is about revenge, and now it's empty, so yes.
That is true. Although, it's mostly Miller driving for the revenge.
Yeah, I really don't like the way Miller is written in that game. He just always comes off as a huge asshole.
Well, like, Ocelot is like, here's a reasonable course of action, and Miller's like, no, don't do that, Snake! Don't do it! I'm surprised he and Ocelot haven't gotten in a fist fight over this.
Although, perhaps I guess they have, it's just off-screen.
Well, it'd also be really unfair because Miller's missing an arm and a leg.
Yeah, I feel like Miller would try to instigate, and Ocelot would de-escalate, and Ocelot is, you know, a super spy who got the nickname Shalashaska because he became a sword fighter in Afghanistan while you were in a coma. So that's not really a fair fight.
Also, he's like in peak physical condition. Yeah, it just...
And Ocelot is protected by canon. He can't possibly die. And you could explain Miller's death in that game.
Anyway.
Fun.
Not really a whole lot other than that. I've been playing a lot more Smash since Corn and Bayonetta came out, having mixed results. I have this unfortunate thing where I do in most games, and I think I mentioned this on the podcast before, is if I'm playing someone slightly better than me, but I mean,
clearly, you will beat yourself to death against it.
Yeah, they are a rock wall upon which I will crash over and over.
So you subscribe to the Imperial Guard stratagem of, I will throw enough of my time and life against this rock and eventually I will wear you down.
I mean, eventually I'll beat them, but my thing is, I need to play people who are better than me to get better. The problem is, I really only get about 4 matches of learning off of it, and then I need to take some time to process it, but I don't give myself that time to process it, and I just keep going at it. Doesn't work super well. So mostly just Smash and a little, actually mostly Metal Gear with a little bit of Smash.
I'm really sad Snake didn't end up being one of the DLC characters, but that was such a long shot.
I really liked him in Brawl, though. I'm kind of sad they didn't bring him back.
Yeah, but with the way Konami is treating Snake.
That's true, which is sad because Phantom Pain is a great game.
Yeah, oh. Hopefully Hideo Kojima does something great with Sony's money. We'll see.
Did he get hired by Sony then?
No, he didn't. He made his own company, but Sony was like, have some money and make some PS4 games.
Because we need more of those. And he's like, yeah, sure. I would really like to see another Silent Hill game.
The fact that Guillermo del Toro and Hideo Kojima were going to make a Silent Hill game, and we didn't get it, is...
Well, you know, if they really wanted to, you could get Guillermo del Toro and Hideo Kojima to make totally not Silent Hill.
Del Toro has basically said, video games, they always hurt me. No. Because this is like the fifth Del Toro project that has fallen through.
Oh, wow.
In video games.
As real as... Actually, now that you've... I forgot he was one of the co-writers of PT, but it really shows now that I think about it.
And imagine a horror game that was like Phantom Pain.
Or main... I'm not even sure how that would work. I feel like I don't a know sandbox how horror game would...
Well, okay. I don't know how you'd be able to do that, a Phantom Pain-like game, because it's like, there's the monster! I want him for my research. I'm kidnapping the monster with the balloon!
I was more talking about the plot twists and the way that opening scene works, and...
Yeah, I would like more of that opening scene with horror themes on it. That would be good. Although that opening was... Man, that was brutal. That almost turned me off of the game, because I have to, like, kind of vet what games I'm going to be playing with Alex in the room. And that almost did it.
Yeah, there are definitely some moments in Metal Gear Solid 5, but they are far between. What happens in the opening that's really... Is it you resetting bones, or... Oh, a lot of times, huh? There's all those civilians getting killed and you having to play dead.
There's a lot of bloody slaughter. Honestly, the very first, like... Maybe the first, like, 2 minutes is probably the worst. Like, the having to play dead part wasn't that bad. It's mostly, like, there's a lot of gratuitous blood that doesn't show up anywhere else in the rest of the game.
So, I've got a question. Did they have an option to skip that?
No, I don't think so.
That seems interesting, because I remember that Modern Warfare 2 had that...
That's because it was sensitive subject matter. You're killing innocent civilians. In this, you're around innocent civilians who are getting killed by the bad guys, mostly to illustrate, I think, that they're the bad guys. Like, I don't really know what purpose there is to the level they take that to, other than...
I was just curious. That instance in Modern Warfare 2 isn't really that interesting in the first place.
No, the best thing about the opening of Metal Gear Solid 5 is the fact that you're playing a cripple slowly trying to recover, and you're like crawling
that
across.
Really, the first 2 minutes aren't what you're talking about, because the first 2 minutes are Snake almost standing up and then falling face forward on the ground, and then trying to get his new hook hand onto a banister and falling onto the ground. And then, like, trying to steady himself with a chair, but it's a chair that's on wheels and it goes flying out from under him and he hits the ground.
So, yeah, maybe what I'm thinking is, like, when you're locked in that cage with all the civilians.
No, I definitely know what you mean. And there's definitely all those, like, innocent people who go out near the hallway and there's a helicopter that strafes them.
Yeah, actually, specifically the one where the doctor gets chopped in half by the machine gun fire from the helicopter. I think that was specifically the moment I'm thinking of.
Okay.
But,
yeah.
I mean, it's not, like, for me, it's not really that bad. For someone with a gore sensitivity like Alex has, it's worse. But, honestly, it's been a great game so far, so I really like it.
All right, what have you been playing, Zach?
Well, I've been playing a lot of League lately. On Tuesday, me and a bunch of friends went and saw Deadpool.
Also bloody, and perhaps if you have a gore thing, don't see that movie.
Yeah, it is.
Chimichangas!
It is, he only mentions chimichangas once in the movie.
That's sad, because that's kind of his catchphrase now, even though I don't think he says it that much.
Not so much anymore. There was a brief bit from like 2011 to 2013 that was all chimichangas all the time.
It's good. I would recommend it if you like those, but it is not a kid's movie.
But
by any stretch of
the it's rated R for don't let children.
Yes, but even then, a lot of like rated R movies you could take kids to because they're rated R for like a language thing. But this movie like really got the most out of its R rating.
It uses its R rating.
I understand there's some Ryan Reynolds dick in there.
Really? Ah. Ryan Reynolds pepperoni dick? Or
I don't remember anything like that in the movie, but could be right.
It was just what I was told. I haven't seen it yet.
Fire Emblem Fates came out. I got that. Been playing it.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably going to buy it tonight.
So based
which
on
one are you going to buy first?
I don't know.
So based on our discussion, it sounded like Birthright was the one to start with. Which one did you start with?
Birthright.
Okay.
It's going to be the one where you're a good guy.
Birthright.
No. Okay.
I wish they had done it so that there's more time for both sides to kind of be like, there isn't a right side, but like right out of the gate, the guys you start with, the Nora side, is like, these guys are massive douchebags. I don't even care. Like, it could have been the other way around. I could, you know, actually belong to this family as a bloodkin. You're an asshole.
Good
but
to know.
As Jeremy has said, Tyler's very vindictive, so, you know, he would do something like that.
I would do what now? Kill
you,
someone?
You would not forgive a slight. You will not forgive a slight in anything.
That's true. I'm totally a vindictive asshole. That's what are you basing this on?
That's definitely what I've said about Tyler and not someone else.
But like the first instance you get of the two different like rulers, one ruler shows up and says, kill these two unarmed prisoners. And like that's the first instance you get of him. And the other one's like, I'm so glad you're here. Okay, they're both supposed to be my parents, and one is clearly more interested in my well-being. One thing that so far I've seen is that initially, the family that your character was supposedly raised with seem to be decent, at least to your character. So, like, that is one reason why you might want to pick the other way around, but it's like, you know, I don't want to stand with a guy who tried to kill me.
I like good guys. And the more fantasy a setting is, the more I want them to be good guys. Like Metal Gear Solid, yeah, we can be this weird private military corporation with a one-armed cripple telling me to kill everyone. But that's super military. In fantasy, I want
to be the hero.
Yes.
Well, I'm interested to see how Conquest plays. Because I did download the other path. I got Birthright, and I'm playing Birthright first. But I'm interested to see how Conquest changes things. Because I want to know if it's like the working from the inside to try and change things as opposed to external conflict.
One thing I read in a review was that the two games are not that similar, so that's cool. Obviously, they're both Fire Emblem games. They both use the same mechanics. But from what I've read, it sounds like they're very different as far as story and levels. That's good.
And one thing that is kind of cool is they have added a great deal of stuff to it, so it's not as simple as the one we played before. You know, sword beats axe, axe beats lance, lance beats sword.
What beats rat totem?
I'm not entirely sure, but they have it like each class of weapon is either blue, red, or green. And I think if I remember correctly, blue beats green beats red beats blue.
Okay, so opposing colors.
But like each one of them, like, because they have shuriken for ninjas and knives for butlers and a club for the closest thing I have to an axe wielder. Naginatas are basically spears, but I mean, they're a thing. Because the Birthright one you're playing with predominantly Eastern-inspired or Japanese aesthetic characters.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you never really mentioned how the color triangle works. So, like, within weapons groups?
I don't think so. I think each weapon group has a specific color. I haven't seen any others. Like, okay, I've got so two ninjas that both have blue.
I think it's mostly so that, like, shuriken and clubs, for example, can be one group without that feeling super weird.
Okay.
That's the way I'm understanding it, anyway.
I think it's like shurikens and knives are one group. I think axes and clubs are the same group.
Yeah, they're both large two-handed like Skyrim groups those as one weapon type.
But yeah, it's a good game. It's Fire Emblem. It's fun. I'm really digging it so far.
I think I'm gonna pick it up this week. I was planning on holding off. I have so many JRPGs to play. But
one thing that I kind of like, you remember in Awakening, how you could pair teams up with your, you know, each unit would have a partner and be able to do that. The enemies can do that in Fates as well as you.
Okay. I don't know if I like that, but it does sound interesting.
It makes for a difference in play.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned before the podcast, when I realized it does not seem like most weapons have degradation on them.
Yeah, well, again, the review I read said Awakening felt like they were just throwing everything that was good about Fire Emblem together and hoping it worked, because it was going to be their last game if they didn't sell well. And this one feels a lot more like they took what worked in Awakening and improved it.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I'm not that far in, but I've already got two weapons on my character. I have a sword and a dragonstone.
Always cool.
Yeah, always cool.
I don't really consider a dragonstone a weapon, but I guess it is. And it seems really weird if there's not degradation, that why wouldn't they just let people transform all the time? But
well, it's actually storyline explained, but one of the interesting things, in my opinion, is the skill system seem to be different, because I have two ninjas, but they have a different skill.
Isn't that how it worked in Path of Radiance when they first introduced skills? Skills were character-based?
No, they were mainly class-based, but you could also get a specific type of skill. Like, you could give somebody a skill, but a lot of them already had skills that were applied. These seem to be skills that characters get passively.
Eh.
And may have different ones for each character.
That is kind of cool. I actually think Path worked that way. And that the only character-based skill was whatever the ultimate skill was.
You could be right. I don't remember exactly, but they do learn different skills, and there are different things. Like, ninjas, if they hit somebody, they will actually reduce their stats for a short time.
Cool.
Poison?
One of my ninjas...
I'm fighting a ninja. Ah!
Base stats will go down if they hit for a short time. But I do have a ninja that has a poison on his attacks.
Since they're all Japanese-based, are they all new classes? Because it kind of sounds like...
Kind of. Like, I have two Pegasus Knights, but they're labeled Sky Knights, but they're basically... Pegasus Knights. And then I have two that are basically Myrmidons, but they are labeled Samurai.
Okay.
So, like, they're labeled slightly different, but they play similarly. The ninja and the spear fighter seems to be the most different.
Oh, not butlers?
I meant of... Yeah, butler is a different kind of class, because it is a knife and stave.
That's interesting.
I don't think I've seen before.
Actually, no, I don't either.
And I guess the songstress is, like, a combat dancer. Like, she's actually got a Naginata.
Well, yeah, the dancer in Awakening had a weapon, too.
Yes, but she's useful in combat.
Well, anyone is useful in Awakening if you train them right. But my dancer ended up being, like, one of my most powerful characters.
Yes.
She was a swordmaster for a while and would just slice up anyone who came near.
That is true. I'd forgotten that you could do that. But, yeah, I mean, it's good. I have a villager on my team.
Is this weapon a sweet pot?
No, her weapon is a spear. She's basically a spear fighter, but she has the same thing that Donnie did in Awakening, with a 10% boost to any stat increasing on a level up. So I'm using her a lot because...
She's good.
Well, that potential is incredible.
She's like Donnie, only she doesn't annoyingly yell, "I'm Donnie!" every time she kills someone.
Why would you do that? "I'm Tyler!" Oh, well, God, she's related to Daisy. "Hi, I'm Daisy!"
No, that's
she
Donald.
She crushes your soul.
That's Donnie out of Awakening, not this chick.
Anything else, Zach?
Like I said, a lot of League of Legends. Mostly ARAMs for some reason. I was playing a lot of ARAM.
Yeah, you know, you wanted to buy some rams and trade them for some goats.
I played a game in which I survived a 8-kill Rengar diving the under turret.
Alright.
That's about it. What have you been playing?
Not much. I started a game as America and got a whole ton of land at the start. Basically an entire island to myself. And by island, I mean continent. The Mongols were there too, but they didn't end up with any land.
It's like they had one little city-state.
Yeah.
So it's like the actual Mongols.
And Germany is taking over the entire world, and I am trying to culture win, like I tried last time. But Germany keeps making this harder, and also people voted to embargo Germany, which made it harder because I couldn't establish trade routes with them too.
Are you going there?
Better.
Are you going to accidentally vote yourself king of the world again?
Possibly. We'll see. I'm doing a lot better this time. I'm pretty rusty on Civ. I haven't played it in a long time. So in the Japan game in the year 2000, I was at World War II technology and feeling terrible. And now I'm in 1860 and at World War II technology. So,
which is better.
Not bad.
Much better.
Yeah, I'm. Last time I played Civ, I was playing Beyond Earth.
Yeah, that's the only thing I think I've been playing. I keep trying to start Yokai Watch and things happen. Little more Persona 3, but that game is boring. Persona 3 is amazing. Just don't play the second campaign.
I'll keep that in mind.
That's pretty high on my list of games to start next. I think I have Captain Toad Treasure Tracker.
Yeah, I need to play that too.
I haven't even opened the copy that Jeremy got me for Christmas.
Man, Yoshi's Woolly World, though, guys.
Do you have that on a disc?
I do.
I might mug it from you.
If you liked Yoshi's Island at all,
I need to play Treasure
Tracker
first.
Yeah, well, so I started playing Treasure Tracker, and then I started playing. I started playing Treasure Tracker, Xenoblade, and Yoshi's Woolly World all at the same time.
I need to play more Xenoblade.
Power through all of Yoshi's Woolly World. Yeah, so I hit a point in Xenoblade where I was like really excited to play it with people, and then I figured out how the multiplayer works. I'm like, eh, this is going to be a long, involved single-player game.
I got to the chance to get the mech, and then just, for whatever reason, stopped.
I only hear good things about that game, but I hear good things and that game is a giant whale made out of other whales that is gargantuan.
Yes.
And that you can get lost in it even before you get the mech, so.
That's very true.
Yeah, that is true.
I've barely played it, and I've already spent an unfortunate amount of time wandering the wilderness.
And I like wandering around. It's just, I don't know. I think I just started playing a lot of League of Legends with the other group of people that actually plays it, because I like playing games with friends a lot, so I tend to be drawn off of single-player games pretty simply.
I feel like it's best to limit your time playing it, if you ever pick it up, to like maybe an hour at a time after you finish the tutorial.
So many JRPGs, like I've said. Undertale is high up on the list. I really want to start Yo-Kai Watch. I think I'm going to play the first Xenoblade first, because I got that for Christmas.
Especially if you have not spoiled Undertale for yourself, do yourself a favor and play it, because you will enjoy it.
Yeah, I know. So speaking of big, giant whales of games, imagine 1996.
Okay.
And okay. Final Fantasy III is coming out, and that's basically what it is. For the time, Final Fantasy VI is a giant game with a ton of content. And when you think you've just beaten it, it turns out you're only halfway through, and there's basically an entire another game to play.
I've noticed that with Tales of Symphonia was like that, too.
It's a very common JRPG thing, and it's really cool. In Persona 3 is where it really hit me. If you're into the game, that really works, because you don't want the game to be over, and it's cool and it's not over.
Yeah, it just, I don't know, having basically two endpoints, like an endpoint.
It's supposed to be
like
a twist, right?
A false endpoint. I don't know, like, it feels more like getting kicked in the nuts. You're like, I finally accomplished my goal, and I'm not done yet.
Except in Final Fantasy VI, you don't accomplish your goal. You fail.
That's even worse, but I think that would motivate me to actually turning around and powering through to actually kick the bastard who screwed me over in the nuts.
Zach, we don't have time for this conversation right now, but something I've come to realize is that I shouldn't say most people. I certainly play games to enjoy them and play them. You play games to conquer them. Because you've talked about, you almost take pride in the fact that you don't 100% games. Or I'm like, the games I've 100%ed are my favorite games, because those are the games that I wanted to play until there was no blood left in the stone. Aren't those the best games? I paid the same price for this game as all the other games, but I got so much more fun out of it. Whereas you really seem to be about the end. Yes, I have made it. I have conquered you, game. Now, game, you will pay me 80% of your rice for the rest of time. All right, so Final Fantasy VI.
Yes.
Or III, if you're American, in 1996.
We generally acknowledge it as VI these days.
Yeah. I think from the beginning it sets itself apart from other Super Nintendo games with a very Star Wars-inspired...
That is a very cool effect. Star Wars inspired text crawl.
That just kind of tells you about the world. It's also setting itself apart from other Final Fantasies and going into the direction that pretty much they go to from here, where it starts out with like, oh, those Final Fantasy worlds with like elves and that's over. They all blowed up. This is a steampunk world. This isn't typical fantasy. This is like Victorian, and we've got these cool mechs. And Final Fantasy VII will go even further in what's basically a sci-fi world.
Huh, I had never actually thought of that. A lot of Final Fantasy games don't tend to have other races. It's typically just humans.
And that's a weird bias Americans have, because this is VI. This is sort of the halfway point of the series even today, a little further back than that. But this is where that really starts and they run with it. This is where they're trying to distinguish themselves from Dragon Quest and other sort of generic fantasy settings, and really creating something that people on forums 10 years later will be like, why don't we make a Final Fantasy VI tabletop? And that feels like something that would be different than typical D&D.
Like, the closest you get to other races for a long time after this is, like, Kamari in Final Fantasy X.
Yeah, when they do have other races, they tend to be very weird things that...
Moogles. I know the...
Moogles are a staple of the series.
I know Tactics Advanced includes Moogles, the bunny people, and then lizard people.
Although we talk about, you know, only humans in this, but you definitely get a Moogle and an abominable snowman as a party member in this game. So.
That's true.
I guess human only is not quite the right phrasing, but no, like, elves and dwarves is not...
Yeah, the standard fantasy races don't exist in Final Fantasy.
Standard
fantasy
Final Fantasy 1.
Yeah, where you get elf.
You also go to the dwarf town for a bit.
Oh, yeah, actually, Final Fantasy IV has dwarves, too, in the underworld. They built your airship or something. I forget exactly what they did, but they're helpful.
The fact that standard fantasy race is a thing.
Well, thanks, Tolkien.
Well, yeah, and here's where Final Fantasy is saying, we're not going to do that anymore. I feel like 10 is the most fantasy world of them, but that has a very Eastern feel that...
Yeah, it does, really now that difference. You say it.
It's very Godzilla and also Buddhist.
Yeah.
But we're not playing 10. And I could go on forever about how cool 10 is. And you wanted to talk about the setting about Final Fantasy VI, Tyler. So what do you have to say about it? Can you, like, paint a picture of it? Because I don't know if I did a very good job.
Basically, if you're into steampunk at all, I mean, I guess I should assume that somehow you have not been acquainted with steampunk. But we're in a steampunk fantasy setting. You're, like, late 1800s technology, just getting into the realm of being able to automate and mechanize a lot of stuff. And you also have magic. Specifically, there's an evil empire going, you know what? What if we took those two and made killing death machines with them? And so they have an army of killing death machines that can do that. But you also have, like, castles that can burrow underground. Completely impractical, but if you're at the age of just realizing that you can, like, make a giant automatic drill that can do this sort of stuff, you might do that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, duh. Why wouldn't you make an army of killing death machines because you have steampunk and magic?
I meant this burrowing sandcastle is really...
Oh, why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly. Stupid. It's stupid. But at the beginning of this type of technology in our history, we kind of did stuff like that before realizing it was stupid. But we're, like, right at that cusp of realizing what we can do with machines.
Also, another big part of steampunk is airships.
Oh, yeah, and there are airships because it's Final Fantasy.
Well, actually, I was going to say, I feel like airships become a Final Fantasy thing, but here they're just a steampunk thing, and it worked so well, it was so cool.
It's really
it becomes
just
a Final Fantasy thing.
I mean, they exist in every Final Fantasy game before this.
Do they?
Yeah.
I feel like they're not in one, but I did not beat one.
They might be, or might not be in one. They're definitely in four.
Yeah, but do
least.
You get one in four?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
You get, like, three different ones in four, even, and then a moonship.
Is that the one we already played once?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember you get a skimmer in that, at the very least.
Yeah, it gets upgraded to an airship eventually, and then it gets upgraded to a spaceship that travels to the moon. That game gets weird at the end.
But also you mentioned magic, and this setting does have magic, but we also mentioned Tolkien. And part of the opening crawl is almost like Return of the King happened. The dwarves and elves are gone, and magic is kind of gone too, at the start of things. And the first character we meet, Terra, is special and important and the chosen one because she can wield magic in this world where people sort of accept magic was probably real, but it's kind of gone, and instead we just have these mechs that shoot magic laser beams.
Yay!
Although, as you find out later in the game, there's a reason that mechs can shoot giant laser beams, and it's pretty... the cost they pay for it is somewhat unsavory, but we'll get there.
So, as I said, you start with one character named Terra, and Biggs and Wedge, who are, if it wasn't clear they were riffing on Star Wars at the beginning, it becomes really clear here.
To be fair, I didn't realize it until you mentioned it before we started recording. So.
Yeah, there most certainly are Biggs and Wedge, but isn't there a Biggs, Wedge, and Cid in every single Final Fantasy game?
Starting here, again. Six is also important because...
Cid's in four.
Yeah, Cid is in four. Cid is common. But Cid isn't a Star Wars thing.
No, he's not.
Here's where I feel like a lot of Final Fantasy tropes get their start. And part of that might be because this is the first one that really took off in North America.
And they're like, what can we do to make subsequent games sell this well?
If this game has one big flaw, it's that the tutorial slash the opening goes on probably a little too long.
A little?
A little?
Okay, probably 10 times longer than it needs to go, if we're being honest. Although I feel like it's probably best if you cut it in half.
I feel like being able to wander through town in those mech suits just obliterating stuff and then losing that is kind of cool. But the boss that you have to fight first, just, eh.
Well, I don't even really care. You have a mech and then Biggs and Wedge also in mechs, just walking through this town, one-shotting everything. That's not terribly interesting because you're just one-shotting everything without any
That's
real
true.
Way. You don't really have any knowledge of why you're here or why you're supposed to care about why you're wandering through the city massacring everything.
Also, Terra's magic is completely ineffective compared to the mech.
It kind of reduces the effect and makes it just drag.
And I totally agree with you, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. And the way people defend it, and the reason I think that's in the game, is if you've never played a turn-based RPG before, this is not a kind one. Because if you are, like, looking through all the options, it's an active type battle system, so you're going to keep getting hit and hit and hit while you're playing with these options. So the way it's defended by most people is that you basically can't lose, because if this is your first time with the genre, you're going to want to experiment. You might not know what's going on.
Well, that means their tutorial needs to actually be tutorialized rather than making you an immortal god slayer for the first 20 minutes.
And I can see it either way, because I kind of think the more subtle your tutorial, the better. And this is very subtle, but you could just like have a text screen pop up and explain things and get it done faster.
Well, I mean, like the Mass Effect tutorial, similar idea, that very first planet, but you aren't a god slayer, but you are learning what you need to know to play the game. In a situation where you're not really in danger of losing.
And I mean, I feel like the default best tutorial is World 1-1 of Super Mario Brothers. I mean, everyone has analyzed how good that first mushroom they give you is.
Or Mega Man X, that first level.
Oh
is
yeah,
Ego so
Raptor
good.
Has that great thing on Mega Man X. But I feel like everybody who's ever written about video games scholarly has talked about why Mario 1-1 is good. And this is no Mario 1-1. But I think they're trying to take things from that and apply them to this much more complex system. And I agree, it doesn't really
It does not work. Come off super well. Eventually you fight a slug. It's trying to teach you about a cool mechanic that will never appear again.
And then you go into another story thing where basically the mechs are destroyed, Terra wakes up. You see some flashbacks that are important because they establish her character. You find out she was basically mind-controlled by an evil clown.
Yes, yeah. He's a clown. It becomes more obvious when you see paintings of him or see him in combat.
And then you wake up and there's a thief named Locke and you've joined the Resistance. Again, very Star Wars. Fighting an evil empire.
And then welcome you need to the Resistance. I joined the Resistance?
You did now.
You were signed up.
And then you have to run out of town. By the way, that I love this town that you
Narche?
First started. Yeah. Partially because it's a cool set piece. It's dark. It's gritty. It looks like a crappy place to live. But there's like steam pipes everywhere and they're basically heating all the houses with like water heating. From the side of the mountain. It's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. The visuals in this game are great. All across the board. The sprites have a whole bunch of different expressions. And they do a lot of storytelling. Basically in cutscenes. Before cutscenes were invented. Just with the sprites on the screen. I don't know. What word I was thinking for?
One effect that I kind of liked. Because it changed things up. Was the defense of the unconscious Terra. When you were running away. You have Locke and I think two squads of Moogles.
Oh yeah.
To stop the.
I forgot that part was then, but you're right.
And in fact, they do that in this game, or not that specifically, but they have things like that where you're trying to defend points or like trying to. Like, there's a point at which you're waging a war and you have to control squads going a bunch of different ways. Actually, in Narsha, I think you're trying to defend a random Esper or something to that general effect.
I really like that effect because most Final Fantasy games don't, or most games in general, doesn't Final Fantasy or whatever.
Your characters are never helpless.
Well, and they don't include stuff like that where, I mean, Fire Emblem has a couple of them, but that's a very different type of game.
Yeah, just because I don't know that we explained it that well. Basically what happens is you have different squads of party members. Here it's a bunch of Moogles and then Locke, and you move them around almost like a tactical game. Through a bit of terrain and enemies are walking towards you, and if enemies touch one of your squads, it starts a fight.
And you're trying to prevent them from reaching the unconscious Terra.
When I talk about how good this game is, that's one of the things I'm talking about, because that's basically a tutorial for when the game goes into that mode. And later on, this game has a ridiculously large cast, so that's one of the ways that they let you use all your characters instead of having a bunch of them just hanging out on the ship, is you have these little almost war segments where you have to make four different parties. And defend points like that.
Interesting.
The downside is it doesn't level your characters for you, but we'll get there later.
This is kind of what I'm talking about. The tutorial is too long. They need to tutorialize that. And that's a cool point. It's a cool moment, but it is serving more tutorial. It's sort of delaying the start of the game. So then you go to this castle.
Friend of the Resistance, Figaro. But that's how they introduce the castle is... Like, friendly town of the Resistance, Figaro, or something to that effect.
And the King of Figaro, Edgar, joins you. It's a, like Tyler said, it's a burrowing castle, which is good for defense because it can burrow into the ground and
it's
leave.
It's not quite as simple as they make it out
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, it doesn't just, Edgar joins you, you have to... So, this game occasionally, and this is not the worst game I've played in this vein, JRPGs occasionally have, like, a series of people or events you have to trigger in order to move on.
JRPGs,
and sometimes obtuse what you actually need to do.
JRPGs, I've noticed, and even mostly it's these older ones, have very rough guide dang it things where it's like, I need...
Like, you really need a quest marker, but it's not there.
Yeah, you need to do something specific in order to trigger this, but it doesn't tell you what you need to do.
I said on the Chrono Trigger episode that I like this game more than Chrono Trigger. I've changed my mind about that. There are things this game does, ideas that I want to see explored. Whereas I've talked about how Chrono Trigger, to me, feels like a proto-BioWare RPG, and BioWare took up the torch of Chrono Trigger and is making games like it. People say all the time, I want a Chrono Trigger sequel, and I understand that, but BioWare games fill that itch for me pretty well.
They're spiritual successors, if not direct successors.
Yeah, nothing's really done that with Final Fantasy VI, but it's not as polished as a game as Chrono Trigger, and part of that is those guy dang it moments. Chrono Trigger has two in its entirety, and those are still bad, but they're really forgivable, because for the most part, it's very good about leading you where you need to go. There are a ton, both in this intro part and later on in Final Fantasy VI, where it's like, how was I supposed to know that I had to talk to Bob, who's over there drinking his coffee, because he's going to tell me something important about the plot before I can advance? There are just too many places like that in this game.
And to be fair, some random guy does tell you you need to talk to everyone, but like after a while, getting so much useless information out of everyone, you kind of become inured to the need to do that. Or, like, I think in this particular case, you need to, like, go visit the tower to trigger a cutscene or something. Like, it's not a place you would think to go, because you can see it from outside the screen. There's clearly nothing there, but then you have to go up there anyway.
Yeah, I think I thought I had gone through all the way through the castle, and nothing had happened.
I remember the second time I played this game, I forgot when that cutscene was supposed to happen. So I went there, did basically what you did, then left, rented a chocobo, and wandered around the wilderness for a while.
Yeah, and the other reason that I don't think this game is as good as Chrono Trigger is the combat. The combat in this game isn't bad. It's one of the first active time battle combats. So you basically have a bar that's filling up on your characters, and when it fills, you can go, but enemies go while you're making decisions. I've talked in Chrono Trigger about why I don't like that. Mm-hmm. But this has basically all the problems that RPG combat has, and Chrono Trigger just does it better. Chrono Trigger made it more interesting with combo attacks and enemy formations.
Well, the fact that you can encounter enemies on the overworld map instead of going to a separate scene.
Yeah, so you can
makes
duck
it so that,
a combat.
Yeah, you can avoid it.
And I don't really fault Final Fantasy VI for its random battles because it came before Earthbound or Chrono Trigger. There is a period between like 1998 and 2004 where people are still just using random battles, and there's no reason to because better systems have been invented.
Like the Chrono Trigger Earthbound system.
Really, every RPG should just use Earthbound system. Persona uses a slightly modified version of it, and it's great. Because it makes wandering around the map a more active thing, because if you want to try to avoid enemies, you have that option. If you want to fight enemies, you can head them straight on. And if you want to try to get an advantage, you can try to hit them from behind and start the fight advantaged, instead of just them happening or not.
Yeah.
Although, does Earthbound ever do the thing where if you're over-leveled for that encounter, you just win?
Yes.
Okay.
That originates in Earthbound.
Because that's, like, one of my favorite random-ish encounter things that ever got invented.
That way, when you're wandering around in the first area, that level 2 Pidgey doesn't try and stand up to your level 79 Mewtwo?
Yeah. I was so glad when Monokemia did that. Although, say, in Pokemon, it makes sense because you might want to catch the Pidgey because you missed it. But, I mean, it's Pidgey. Do you really care? But in other, like, in random JRPGs where you really don't care about the enemies, like, in fact, I would even say go the Bravely Default route and allow you to just turn the encounters off.
Yeah, well, Bravely Default has random encounters, but it does something with it. There are so many lazy games. Like, and even Final Fantasy, they did it too long, but they eventually got off of it.
With Bravely Default. Actually,
well,
no, they
12,
did it before.
12 does
then.
It yeah, 12 does encounters. It. And 10 was supposed to, but it didn't pan out.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah, this is a digression, but you know at the beginning of 10 when you're with Auron and he's, like, sort of tutorializing you
and you can see all the enemies on the road?
Yeah, in, what's it called, Xanarkand. Yeah. And he's even like, don't kill everything, just focus on the ones that matter and let's run. Originally, the game, the areas between cities were just going to be long stretches of combats. And if you killed certain enemies blocking you, you would go on to the next one.
Huh.
But it felt like there wasn't a world because the only places you could explore were cities.
Gotcha.
Because everything else was combat.
And yeah. Then you need the random combat to make sure that you actually fight something while exploring.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like that's kind of the problem that Final Fantasy falls into a lot. Although, I mean, like, Chrono Trigger, that isn't a problem. In fact, the overworld map just doesn't have encounters.
But the bigger thing I think is problematic with Final Fantasy VI's combat, I don't want to say it's boring, because I don't think it is, but a lot of it is rote.
These
encounters very rarely switch up. And while we talked about that annoying slug, that's an encounter that
could
switches
be interesting.
Up. And I wish they tried more things like that. That one sucks, but that would make random combats more interesting, give you more choices.
I agree with you, and I actually do find the combat boring. The only reason that slug is annoying is because you can't stop your guys from attacking when it will hit them back brutally hard.
Like, you've issued a command, and then it does something that you didn't expect before issuing the command. That doesn't happen super often, but in any game like this, that's a problem. Especially when you don't know when your enemy's going to move. Like, if I knew it was going to go, I would wait for it to go, and then go.
Yeah, I could plan around it, but because you can't do that, you don't have that option. But the base combats, like Jeremy said, it's mainly just I wait for my bar to fill up and kill whatever it was that I just happened to be annoyed at.
And later in the game, it ends up being I've discovered an optimal configuration for a team, do the same thing over and over. Eventually, you get a bunch of, like, equip or artifacts, accessories. They're called accessories in this, right?
It becomes SOP, which makes combat boring.
Yep. You say, okay, I'm mostly just grinding this one magicka now.
And that's the problem with turn-based RPG combat. The bosses are often interesting and will do new things. It's just not super interesting in other fights. Pokemon gets around it, like Tyler said, by giving you the option to catch this. Every random encounter is potentially a victory in Pokemon. Well, and you're going to have tons with Pidgeys you don't care about, but that's just going to make when you finally get the encounter with
a Pikachu or something
more exciting.
And you also have weaknesses and strengths against Pokemon. And later ones add like certain effects like Sturdy.
Yeah.
You can't really run an SOP type thing against those, but in a lot of these other ones, you just have... You know, this is the optimal strategy.
Like,
so standard what you operating mean by SOP for
standard,
the
that's what I was about to do.
Standard
SOP is standard operating procedure. So it's this is the optimal thing to do. So standard procedure is I do this tactic and win.
Like eventually I get Locke with the X attack accessory and two Atma weapons, and then Terra with or maybe Celis. Usually Celis. I like her better anyway. With the X magic thing and some other stuff, and or I think the magic gem box or something. Basically, they get to attack 8 times each turn, and then everyone else is just there for support.
I mean, sometimes that standard operating procedure can be fine. It can be fun to have something like that.
Well, like Bravely Default, I'm having a lot of fun with Vampire Tiz, but...
In Fire Emblem, the first one, it is Hector plus Oswin, and you march them across the map. But there's a lot of other stuff that is going on around it that really... helps.
You're making choices because you have to react to random crits and things that
and
don't
other people
happen.
Moving around your main thing. But when you end up in a game like this, it's okay, this enemy, I have, you know, these 4 characters that complement each other so well that I can basically just push one button and then watch the enemy melt, which makes the combat itself meaningless.
Yeah, so the combat is not really, it's more setting up that party that's interesting in this game.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The fun part is figuring out what the optimal combination is and trying new SOPs and finding the one that's really good and seeing them improve. But the random encounters basically exist to give you something to do. And they probably do make the game a little more interesting than if it was just wander to boss, wander the boss.
Well,
but they still get boring.
I guess that is one of the reasons why I like Ogre Battle so much is because that's what is like the main thing for that. I hadn't thought about that for a standard JRPG like this because most of them don't have that kind of thing. Or they run into the problem of the characters don't level up together. So it's like, this unit could be really good together, but because this person's level 5 and these guys are level 45, he's basically useless.
And this game does a little bit to mitigate both of those things by basically certain parts of the story, you're locked to this certain party, which both makes it so certain party members are going to level up even if you're not using them all the time, because suddenly you have to.
Like, who uses Gwar?
Gwar's actually pretty good.
Ah, man.
He's a pain in the ass to control, but I think whether or not you use Gwar or not depends entirely on which rage you randomly selected to use the first time. And if you find one of the good ones, you're like, oh man, this character's really cool. And if you find one of the crap ones, you're like, why would I ever use this character?
What? A rage? Yeah. He's like a barbarian?
He's like a blue mage. Except for you choose an enemy from the list of all the enemies, and you
mimic them, basically. Yeah. So, like, if you encounter one of those Magitek walkers that you get early in the game, you start fighting them later, Gwar can learn how to be those, and he'll just do what those things do, which is pretty nice. But, like, I don't know, blue mages were never my favorite class in Final Fantasy games until Bravely Default because of Gwar.
Fair enough. And I think it's entirely, if he starts with, like, 20 of them or something, which is too many. So if you pick one of the ones just from this random list that's one of the good ones, I know one of the good ones now, and it's useful, so you'll probably like him. And if you pick one of the crap ones, you're like, I can't even control that this character does.
So when he does that, you can't control him anymore.
He just becomes that enemy for all intents and purposes.
You can't control what he does, but he does not have any resource consumption. Like if he casts Fire 12 because the
Fire
enemy
12.
Knows that move, it doesn't cost him MP.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
All the characters are pretty cool. There aren't many generic ones.
Yeah, that's the one I wanted to transition into from there is another thing that makes this, they try to make interesting about this game is making all the characters new interesting classes. Like, a lot of them are just class combinations from previous Final Fantasy games, but they try to do new stuff with them. Terra is a mage for all intents and purposes, but she also has pretty good physical fighting strength.
She also has overdrive mode, basically, where she becomes super mage in full Esper form.
So she has interesting stuff. Celis is very similar to Terra, so you can... So if you want, you can train one to be a mage and one to be a fighter.
But she can also tank magic as her special ability. Granted, I think Celis, Terra, Edgar, and Locke are probably the most generic characters in the game in terms of their combat mechanics. Like, Edgar's thing is he gets tools that he can use. They're mostly just replacements for his physical attack, though, so...
I'd say they're more like spells, but you have to buy an item and own that item instead of casting MP.
Yeah.
So some of them are just physical attacks, like Chainsaw and Drill. But then some are like Flash, which does magic damage and has a chance to blind.
What's Locke's thing? Can he steal? Is that it?
He's a thief.
Yeah. I mean, eventually it becomes Mug, which is slightly better.
Because it deals damage.
Yeah. Generally, though, Locke is probably the most generic RPG character in terms of his combat mechanics, although he gets really good strength and speed at the end of the game, so he's pretty good for hitting stuff in the face repeatedly.
And then Shadow is a ninja. He throws any item you have and... You lose that item, but it does damage. That becomes a super standard Final Fantasy thing, but I believe this is the first game with that. Five might have it.
Isn't like the way to do the most damage? You throw the Muramana at
Edge Cannon 4, actually, now that I think about it.
Oh, okay.
He can throw Masamunes at people.
Yeah.
So, Masamune, not Muramana. Well, Muramana is a wildly different thing.
Well, there's also Muramasa, Masamune, and Muramasa. Did I ever say Muramasa? I don't know. There's like three combinations of those.
Masamune is an item in League of Legends.
Oh, well. Masamune is also a famous sword named after a Japanese weaponsmith who may or may not have existed.
So what can the other characters do? I think we should run through them. Sabin is, I think, one of the most interesting ideas they had. That was not a good idea. But they decided to run through
it. Is that the train suplex guy?
Yes. Sabin is a fighter, a monk-type character. And the way they decided to make his moves is... Basically, he has Street Fighter-style button input commands.
Oh,
for his
moves.
God. You pick one out of a list, and then you have to do... it's pretty loose timing. I played this before I played any Street Fighter. Yeah.
I repeat. Oh, God.
Well, the thing is, you don't have to do it with any timing. Like, to do a Hadouken, you have to do that movement smoothly and then hit the button.
But
to
you
do
can
a
do
Sabin
it as...
move, you just have to hit the buttons in order.
Yeah, you have. You can do it as slow as... So you can
That's
do
not
down,
as bad as I had thought.
Down, forward, forward, A... And you could, like, take 15 minutes. There's a time limit on it, but it's, like, 30 seconds or something. It's really long.
And they're even more generous to you, because if you hit down and forward on a Super Nintendo controller at the same time, sometimes it will register it twice. The way they got around it is if there's ever a diagonal, you can always just press one of the two buttons in the diagonal, and it will read it. So it's very generous. The problem is you have to remember his moves. And that's not super hard, but...
Eventually, you will only be using the same, like...
prompts on it?
No, it does not have prompts.
You
can go to the start menu and look at spells. That will show you all his prompts. But when you're in the middle of a fight...
You will have to have remembered it. And the first time you have to use it, it doesn't really tell you what it is. So that's kind of a... I think that was a point we wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
It's
the worst part of the tutorial is teaching you Sabin's moves. Because you're in a boss fight. It's a timed boss fight. You will win instantly if you do one of Sabin's moves, but it doesn't tell you about Sabin's moves until you have about 20 seconds left. And if you are doing the input at the wrong time, or you're not really sure how to do it, you will die, get a game over, and...
Have to do it again.
Yeah, and...
That's annoying!
Yeah, it is.
It is the worst design decision in this game. But it's a good transition into what game overs do in this game.
We didn't hit all the characters, really... though.
Yeah, I'll come back to that.
Okay.
But game overs are actually really generous in this game, I think. Physically, you're transported back to the last part you saved at, and that's annoying. and you lose any items and money you've gathered between dying and going back to the save.
Don't you keep all the experience?
Yeah, you retain all of your experience, though. So if you are struggling to get to a boss, going through lots of random encounters,
you don't
gain
have to
six
grind
levels,
quite as much.
And then die to the boss, you keep all those levels. And in theory, getting to the boss a second time will be easier. And
you lose
you'll
gain
all more
the,
levels.
You lose all the items you gained in between those. Do you regain any items that you used?
No, I don't think so.
I don't know. That's a good question.
And because I can't, I don't know.
I don't think so. I know the reason they did that is because then they all, when you die, you reset all the treasure chests. So you would, if they didn't, you would be able to do weird exploit things where you could get like a legendary armor, die on purpose, then get it again. I don't know if your items reset to how they were before, though. Or
I think they just reset. That would make the most sense.
That's true. Actually, I think you're right now that you say that.
So you would regain any items that you use.
Yeah, I think you do. But like Tyler said, we haven't talked about all the characters, and I would like to at least touch on them all. Then there's Cyan, who is another...
I love him as a character.
He's another good idea that I don't think is executed very well.
Yeah, his special kind of sucks.
He's a samurai, and so his special is Bushido, which basically has 9 levels. And when you choose to do Bushido, it charges up like your regular active time battle thing.
The downside is you can't issue any other commands while you're waiting, and the higher level commands are not necessarily better than the lower level ones.
So it's a cool idea because what you're giving up is the chance to give orders for a more powerful attack. Unfortunately, it's just not balanced very well.
Like, the level 8 attack might be what you want to do, but then you have to wait that long, and really you could probably have done the level 3 and been better off in the long run.
Because you're hitting more often?
Yeah, mostly because you're not having to wait. Because, like, if you're waiting for Cyan to go and your other characters are now done charging while you've been waiting for Cyan to figure out what move he's going to do, then you've lost out on the opportunity to do more damage. That's kind of what the active battle time or active time battle system loses out on. I feel like Final Fantasy X, again, kind of did the differentiation a bit better, where it's just you have a turn order, here's your turn order, you can see what it is.
Yeah, and if you... More powerful attacks put you farther back in the turn order before you come back around.
But like with like Waka's limit break, for example, he has the roulette, right?
Yeah.
Imagine like if you had to do the roulette, but also everything was moving while you're waiting for the slots to line up.
Oh,
because that's basically what this is.
So speaking of slots, next character is Setzer, and his special ability is Waka's slots.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep.
It does pause while you're doing the slots, or rather the rest of the battle pauses.
A lot of the special abilities pause.
Is
I think
it for
Saturn's
like,
do too.
Damage or effects?
Yeah. Certain things do damage, certain things are heal. It depends on what 3 symbols you match up.
And if you don't match up any symbols?
You get a very small group heal.
I think also what weapon he has equipped affects what the slots are.
Some of his weapons will.
Which is actually kind of cool. Setzer's a fun character, although he's kind of swingy, which makes him not a great one to have in a consistent party.
If you can consistently do the slots, they're not entirely random. He's really good, but they move a little too fast for that to be fun, I think. So I don't really care for him.
I like him as a character. I don't actually have him in a party very
just
often.
Just speaking mechanically.
Yeah.
And then is Realm next?
Yeah, Realm, an old man whose name I can't remember.
Yeah, Realm, an old man.
Who's her grandfather. He's actually a really important and pretty useful character. I just can't remember his
name. So it's like a combined character?
No, you just get them at the same time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're two separate characters who dress similarly, but beyond that.
Yeah, Realm is the granddaughter of old man whose name I should really know because we're doing this podcast, but I cannot think of it. Anyway, Realm is kind of a blue mage as well. She's got like a mind control tentacle that will cause an enemy to do certain attacks against the enemy party. It's kind of terrible. It sounds really cool, but...
That is a cool concept.
A lot of time, enemies are just immune to a bunch of the powers.
I hate it when that happens.
He's an okay idea, but not great. And then old guy who's... He's basically a... Not exactly a blue mage, but certain attacks, when they hit him, he'll learn. So basically a blue mage.
Yeah, that's basically a blue mage.
I think that's all the characters I got on this playthrough.
Well, there's
Mog.
There's Mog.
Mog is a Moogle. You actually get him during that first cave defense, but later he joins you.
He can learn dances in various environments, which will have a set of effects. So, like, he has a cave dance, I think, is my favorite. It causes rock slide fairly regularly.
And if you use the dance appropriate to the terrain you're currently on, all of his attacks are way more accurate.
Strago is the...
Strago, okay. And then, I know you get an Abominable Snowman later, but those are all the characters I actually got in this playthrough.
Yeah, Abominable Snowman mostly just berserks. I don't use it very frequently. There's also, what's his name? Go-Go. which is heavily implied to maybe be Locke's dead thieving companion, who is, I think, maybe distinct from the dead girlfriend. I'm not really sure how that... Anyway, she's a mimic. He, she, it. It's really... It never says anything and only communicates via body language. Will mimic the attacks of whatever else in your party is going. So if you have someone cast Thunder or Thundaga 3 times in a row and you think that's really useful, you can have your mimic go, I want to do what that person just did. And it ends up being a pretty nice ability to have.
So you have a lot of characters to choose from to create your party. And then on top of that, you have the magic system in this game, which gives you more customization. Basically, the way it works, and you don't unlock this until like 10 hours into the game, which is the only downside to it, is you have these things called espers you can attach to characters. While they're equipped, characters will learn spells based on the esper, and you can see which ones it'll learn and how far away it is from learning them.
Oh, so it's a little bit like the Final Fantasy Advanced Tactics weapons thing?
I haven't played Advanced Tactics, so I'm not sure. But sorry, basically, after each fight, in addition to experience, you get magic points. And there's a multiplier based on the spells. So if you have, for example, a Esper that teaches you lightning magic, Thunder 1 might be times 5, Thunder 2 might be times 2, and Thunder 3 might be times 1.
But you can
so
actually...
if you got 2 magic points in a fight, you would get 10 towards Thunder 1, 4 towards
Thunder 2,
and 2 towards Thunder 3.
Ah, okay.
So, but like some Espers teach the same spells as some others, and so they'll usually have different rates on them.
And when you get to 100, you learn the spell.
The other big thing is the attribute points that you get from them.
Yeah, so unlike a lot of JRPGs, your stats don't go up when you level up in this game. Level is used in most calculations, so you'll do more damage as you level up, but your stats stay the same. But each Esper has basically a stat it will improve on that character whenever you level up.
Every character has a certain affinity for stats before you start handing Espers to them, which so you can kind of choose which Espers you want them to have most often.
That's a lot different from how they normally set it up. I wonder why.
Oh, I think they were just trying to experiment. Final Fantasy VII actually does something similar with magic with materia.
Final Fantasy VIII does something similar with stats, actually.
So even though it gives all characters basically a class, like Locke is a thief, you can choose to give him a bunch of strength Espers and level them up and make them really strong. Same with, like I said, Terra and Celis are your mages, but they're both actually pretty physically powerful, so you can choose to train them as warriors that just happen to learn spells instead. It gives you a lot of customization over your party. There's still, you know, optimal things like any game, but there's a lot of experimentation, and you can try to figure out what you want to do.
Like, for example, Sabin really likes having high vitality, so give him Carbuncle.
We're getting towards where we probably want to end here, but I want to talk about the game's greatest strength, which is its characterization and storytelling. Because, like we said earlier, the combat is boring. Optimizing your party so that combat is easy is pretty fun. Leveling up is pretty fun because you have so much control over what you're going to gain when you level up.
Once you get there.
But like most JRPGs, what you're really here for is the story, which is, like I said, very Star Wars inspired. You're a rebel alliance fighting against an evil empire, and the evil emperor is actually not as powerful or as important as his apprentice, who's an evil wizard and a clown.
Also the vizier.
But what really makes this game shine is the characters and the fact that they all get characterization. Celis and Locke might be my favorite romance in a video game. Just
really?
Because it has time to develop.
Well, it kind of tricks you into thinking that it's going to be Terra and Locke, and then it kind of doesn't pan out.
Yeah, and this game almost has a romantic comedy subplot, where they're going through the romantic comedy of obviously they want to be together, but there are these problems, and they break up because of them. And miscommunications occur, and that creates friction for them. But in the end, they get back together.
And that scene with the opera, where she's like basically just singing to Locke.
I want to end on the best moments of this game. Just the characters. Okay. Terra has this like crisis of faith in the middle of the game, where she decides she doesn't want to fight and she wants to be a mother. And this has actually been built up to really well, because as a half Esper, she's afraid that she'll never be able to be loved by anyone. She has this angst, and she like works it out by basically starting an orphanage, and then realizing, oh no, this saving the world thing is probably important and good for these kids.
I don't know that Sabin really has great character. Like, he and Edgar mend their relationship is really their thing.
Well, Sabin and Edgar, what's interesting about them is their backstory, which is slowly revealed to you. And their brothers, Edgar is king, and basically you learn that Sabin was furious when his father died, and they sort of had a coin flip to decide who would get to be king.
Edgar rigged it because he knew he would be the better king and that Sabin wouldn't be happy with it anyway.
Well, but except for that also, both of them didn't want to be king is kind of the twist, and they were both trying to get out of it, but Edgar rigs things so
he kind of took one for the team, as it were.
Because he didn't want to be king, but he knew his brother would be even worse off.
Yeah, pretty much. And then Sabin goes off to be, like, a mountain monk, so...
And Locke, sort of related to his troubles with Celis, has a secret coma girlfriend, that it's his fault she's in a coma.
And Cyan slowly comes to grips with the fact that his entire family is dead. That's kind of a big thing for him, because, and that's actually kind of his motivation for continuing to try to save the world, because Kefka killed his family.
And he has problems with Celis, because Celis is an enemy soldier who defected, and he... saw the enemy poison his family and murder everyone he knows. So there's just a lot of small character interaction moments that they get by splitting the party the way you would a basically in any story with a bunch of characters, like an episode of Justice League. And you can run into problems where some of your characters are underleveled, but for the most part, I think they do a good job of forcing you to use characters in the plot.
There's a large gap towards the end of the game, actually, is the worst part, where you don't have to use them, and then all of a sudden you have to use them for the final boss, and also every single party you form has to fight the final boss, and that can be kind of a problem, because I definitely ran in there where some of my characters were 20 levels under. I'm like, how do I make balanced parties out of these? Granted, that's kind of my fault, because the game tells you, hey, you have a chance to go do, like, this is going to be a thing, this is exactly what's happening. Are you sure you don't want to go level these other characters up really quick? There's a training field over here that would be really useful for that. I'm like, nah, I'm good. And then I got like 2 hours into the final dungeon. I'm like, I should have done that.
I have made a terrible mistake.
One more thing I want to talk about. This game has a huge map for the time. It's kind of small by modern standards.
Well, that's because you got a lot more room on the new discs as opposed to the carts this thing came out on.
Yeah, but it's big. And a lot of the game, I don't want to say you're backtracking through it, but there's a pretty large portion of the game where you have to cross this big world. And so that shows off how big it is. And then you get an airship. And when you're in the airship, it goes into that Super Nintendo Mode 7 and really shows off the world from, like, but you're at this higher perspective. And it really works. And it even makes the world feel kind of small because you can jet anywhere you need to go.
The whole thing with getting your airship, because it turned out that it's actually the airship belonging to this girl that Setzer, like, was basically in a relationship with, and she died in a race because it kept egging her on, and yeah.
But in her will, she left her sweet airship to him.
Getting the airship is a big moment for me.
All right, so let's talk about the biggest moments in the game then. There's obviously Sabin suplexing a train. Everyone talks about that. That's cool. That's an emergent moment. You actually have to do the suplex on the train enemy to get it, but...
I normally just toss a phoenix down at the train.
Yeah, that's the easier... It's a ghost train, so it's way easier to just phoenix down. It's dead.
In fact, the entire ghost train thing, it's Cyan and Sabin, and I think technically Gwar is there.
Yeah, Gwar and Shadow can be there.
But Gwar doesn't say anything, so he's not really... And Shadow's really taciturn, so he basically doesn't say anything, although it's implied he actually knows what's going on, which is kind of weird. Anyway, the whole Sabin and Cyan playing off of each other is kind of nice.
Well, yeah, and that ends with you're on a ghost train because it's the train that goes to the afterlife.
And you meet Cyan's family.
Yeah, at the end of that, Cyan sees his family leaving and he can't do anything about it because he's alive. And so after this silly moment where you suplex a train, there's this really somber moment that's establishing what Cyan's deal is.
The recurring octopus boss, just all the times you fight with him.
Yeah,
it's just mildly amusing.
He's basically a Team Rocket comedic character who's chasing you around and you have multiple boss fights with him.
Just because they wanted some kind of comedic character to be chasing you around?
I think so. Like, you kind of encounter him accidentally, and then you beat him, so he bears you a grudge after that. I think he dies after the end of the world. The opera.
Yeah, the opera is probably the biggest moment. That's what I want to go out on, because it's hard to explain it. Basically, you want to meet up with Setzer because he has an airship.
What, do we want to say that for the end if you think it's the biggest moment?
Well, yeah. Do you have others you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, the end of the world. That's a big moment.
Well, that's the... Lots of JRPGs like to have a twist where it feels like they're building up to an end, and then suddenly there's a whole nother game when you're done.
So we were mentioning earlier that the evil emperor is not really the big bad guy. Turns out the evil emperor is trying to gain the power of the goddesses or something Triforce style, and at the end, Kefka just shoves him off a cliff and steals the power for himself and becomes Dark Overclown of the world. It kind of destroys the world, the party falls apart, you can actually lose Shadow permanently at this point. If you manage to get him with you at all. And then Celis wakes up on an island after a 3-year coma where her alien adoptive father is trying to feed her fish back to health.
Yeah, and then her father dies and she thinks she's the last person alive and tries to kill herself before she sees Locke's armband on a like pelican and is like, he might still be alive. I should go try to live and do stuff.
Those are really the big moments. I guess finding Terra after she went AWOL is kind of cool.
But the biggest moment is probably the opera, which is sort of right before you unlock the magic system. It's just this really cool set piece where basically you want to meet up with Setzer. You know that he wants to kidnap the star of this opera and that Celis is a dead ringer for the star. So under much protest, you convince Celis to dress up as an opera singer and learn opera music.
It's funny because she's like a hardened soldier and she's like, I'm not putting on a dress, guys. This is not happening. Well, and when you save her, she's been tortured in a room for like 3 months and like it's an ugly situation. And then she's like in a dress singing a song about basically about the guy who saved her.
And the music is just incredible. It really sells the whole thing.
For a 16-bit piece with like 16-bit mock vocal tracks, it sounds really good. Like, especially if you're really in the moment. It's just a cool scene to experience.
Well, and it shows the lyrics. You read the lyrics as the song goes, but they match up with the song, and you can imagine what
someone
the opera
actually
is actually like.
It.
And then midway through the opera, the octopus attacks and is trying to drop a sandbag on the cast from the stage. And so in the middle of this opera, you have to interrupt and be on this fight in the stage. And then when that's over, Setzer shows up in his airship.
Phantom of the Opera style.
Yeah, and
crashes
tries to
the
scoop
stage.
Up Celis. And it's just an incredible moment. It is one of the best moments in gaming.
That's Undertale actually has a scene homaging that, where someone's serenading you using the voice from Final Fantasy VI, but the timing, it's hilarious.
And moments like that are what really makes the game go, and what makes some of those slogs of combat worth it.
The downside is, getting there in the first place, there are lots of parts to get stuck at.
Yeah.
Alright, so, without further ado, shall we rank this game?
We should try.
Highly.
Yes, definitely highly. If you don't know, at our website, www.lasttimeonvideogames.com, we have a list of all the video games we've played. At the top is Chrono Trigger, at the bottom is Golden Axe, and in the middle is Crazy Taxi. And while I don't think this is the new top of our list, I think the most comparable game is Chrono Trigger. But like I kind of said in the episode, Chrono Trigger has a more interesting combat system. It does away with random encounters. The characters are also interesting. I don't think they get enough screen time. I don't think they're as well developed as the Final Fantasy VI ones, but they're close enough. And the world of Chrono Trigger has Akira Toriyama making it. And while Final Fantasy VI's world is absolutely beautiful, I think Chrono Trigger's is a little more beautiful.
So it looks better if nothing else. I'm a sucker for time travel. Surprisingly, the plot of Chrono Trigger is more epic in scale, and I think that has a lot going for it.
It's also more straightforward. It's less soap opera-y, and that's not all good, but I think it works with Chrono Trigger.
I do really like the soap opera-ness of Final Fantasy VI, though, because there is a lot of crazy nonsense that happens in that game.
They're both great games. I think Chrono Trigger comes together a little better.
Yeah, I think that's generally the impression. It does a lot of mechanical things that put it above Final Fantasy. I honestly don't think that the characters in Final Fantasy get enough screen time, but they make pretty good use of what they have.
So the next game I think we'll compare it to is another one we mentioned a little bit. Ogre Battle 64, Person of Lordly Caliber.
I love Ogre Battle 64. I played more of it, but like I said, I didn't get very far into this game. Despite the guy dang it things this game consists of, I think it is better than Ogre Battle. Because Ogre Battle does not characterize its characters nearly well enough. The plot kind of jumps around a little bit, and the back half of it is oftentimes overleveled like crazy.
The way I would put it is that they're actually very similar games. They have similar problems and similar strong points. But I think the strong points of Final Fantasy VI are way, stronger. Way better than those of Ogre Battle, even though Ogre Battle doesn't struggle as much with some of the weak points. Ogre Battle's intro is overwhelming, but doesn't go on forever, and it doesn't have anything nearly as bad as the Sabin part, but the highs of Ogre Battle are not nearly as high as the highs of Final Fantasy VI.
I think generally if you're playing both for the story and the characters, Final Fantasy VI is probably better. I actually think I mechanically like Ogre Battle better.
I'd actually agree. But like I'd say, the battles in Ogre Battle and the battles in Final Fantasy VI are the weaknesses. That said, Ogre Battle doesn't really have boss fights in the same way. It does have boss fights, but they're not interesting different encounters. They're just encounters with the numbers turned up.
I turned up the numbers.
So, not quite Midway, but the most RPG-ish thing between them is Fire Emblem for the Game Boy, aka Fire Emblem 7, because numbers are hard in America.
Wait, is that really the seventh Fire Emblem game, Rukino Ken? Holy crap.
It was the first one to come out in America, so still, there's a little bit of... Like, that one makes sense as to why it's only Fire Emblem.
Yeah.
Because here's the first one we've ever released in America. It's Fire Emblem 7.
Well, and Final Fantasy 3 was the third one they ever released in America, so that made sense too. It's just that when Final Fantasy and Nintendo Kung Fu fought for 10 years, and the Final Fantasy was like, fine, we'll just make Sony games, when Sony thought it would be better to use the actual numbering instead of Nintendo's numbering. So we'd go from 3 to 7 all of a sudden, instead of from 6 to 7. But
I prefer Fire Emblem.
I'm actually really torn on this because I really like Fire Emblem.
Okay, I think I've made my decision. A lot of the strong points of both are actually similar. Really good graphics, even though they're sprite-based graphics. Really good, interesting story, mostly driven by the characters, which are interesting. Fire Emblem has a lot more characters, and consequently, it can't focus on them nearly as much. But you get to customize the story you're telling a little bit. You get to choose if you ship Raven and his sister Priscilla, or if you have Raven marry someone reasonable. And Priscilla, like, hang out with her bodyguard.
And who Hector and Ella would marry.
I don't think the story of Fire Emblem is nearly as good, but the gameplay is so much better, and I think that's more important. Though I think Fire Emblem is a little better than Final Fantasy VI.
I think that actually summarizes most of the arguments. I feel like the big moments in Final Fantasy VI are, well, bigger, but I think I had to give it to Fire Emblem.
I think Fire Emblem has two moments that are, I can think of at least two moments. One of them kind of falls a little flat, but the other one is a big deal in the game. Yeah. I don't remember if you've gotten there, and from what I can remember, I don't think you have, so I don't want to spoil it.
I still have to finish that game. Maybe I'll do that this week. I will finish Fire Emblem this week.
The way I'd put it is the opera scene in Final Fantasy VI maybe belongs on the top of a top 10 moments in video game list. It definitely belongs on that list. I don't know that any moment in Fire Emblem belongs on even a top 25 moments list, but Fire Emblem is still a better game all around.
Yeah. Averages much higher.
Yeah.
Just thinking about it, like, just seeing that beautiful pixel art in Fire Emblem, I just, man.
And that's actually what the graphics in Final Fantasy VI on the Game Boy look more like.
Yeah, I was actually noticing that on the Final Fantasy wiki because I've never actually looked at Final Fantasy VI. It looks better, definitely. I still don't think it's quite as good as Fire Emblem.
Yeah, and the sound is a lot worse in the Game Boy version, which actually hurts the opera scene a lot. Okay, a few down, we have a not quite role-playing game, but a Zelda game, Link's Awakening for Game Boy. How do we think it compares there?
I don't care for most Zelda games. I prefer characters in, you know, existing. So I probably, even though I didn't get very far, I'd have to say I would prefer, if I was given the option, to play Final Fantasy VI because of character interactions, than Link's Awakening because Link isn't a non-existent entity.
I mean, there's that poignant moment with Malin.
I was going to say, I said Celis and Locke is the best romance in any video game, and I'll stand by that. Malin and Link in Link's Awakening is strangely affecting to me, and I don't know if that's the age I played it at.
I think that's it for me, because I was one of the first ones I ever saw.
But at the same time, Celis and Locke is the best one. That one is just a good one.
I played Link's Awakening when I was probably about 13, and when the realization struck me that Malin and Link were going to be a thing, and it turns out she didn't exist, really affected me at that age. But no, I
that explains a lot.
It really does. I think Final Fantasy VI is all around a better game than Link's Awakening.
All right, that's 2 out of 3, and I'm not sure where I feel on that. It's a really hard question for me. But that settles it. Final Fantasy... Oh, no, it doesn't. There's one more game to compare it to.
There is. And
Super
this is
Mario
a weird
Brothers
comparison.
3, which is a behemoth of a game. Another game where the graphics are better on the Game Boy Advance version.
All
That's
right.
something they haven't
so
common.
The way I think we have to decide this one...
Who would win in a fight?
Okay, if Mario jumped on all the characters in Final Fantasy VI...
Honestly, I would prefer to play Final Fantasy VI, but that's not like a quantitative judgment. I don't like platformers.
That's a genre thing. But a genre thing is fair when they're... These are two behemoths, right? You have the best platformer on the NES versus one of the best Super Nintendo RPGs, which was the holy... That was the heyday of JRPGs.
I'd say that Final Fantasy VI is a better game than Super Mario 3 because it is more ambitious and does what it is ambitious with well, whereas Super Mario 3 was taking mechanics that had already been used in Super Mario 1, adding some more, but keeping a very, very solid, stable core where it just upgraded a little bit, whereas Final Fantasy VI actually branched out to create all these different character interactions, the different squad things, the story itself, despite the fact that some of these moments sound really derpy to me.
They're kind of derpy, but if you're enjoying the game thus far, you go
with it. Opera Scene sounds cool. Ghost Train, not so much.
I maybe underplayed the Ghost Train. You walk through you'd have to play it.
Suplexing a Ghost Train does not sound interesting.
Oh, no, the stuff that happens before suplexing the Ghost Train is most of the interesting parts.
That's why I would say better than Super Mario 3.
I think it's best that we end on drama, so I will say, I think Super Mario 3 is better, mostly because when it comes to two games that are great, I have to default to which one is more fun to play. And we talked about all the problems Final Fantasy VI has, and the start is so slow. Mario Brothers 3 starts right away. You're running, you're jumping, you're beating
Goombas.
You're getting
mushrooms.
Yeah. You're right.
You're getting a leaf.
So, Tyler, it comes to you to decide.
That's a compelling... Well, unless Zach flips his decision. That is a compelling argument. I would actually have to give it to Final Fantasy VI, though, because Super Mario 3 has been improved upon. I don't know that Final Fantasy VI has really been improved upon, because that is a formula that has never really been tried since.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to say it, it's Final Fantasy VII and Chrono Trigger are the improvements, right? But, as I talked about here, I think Final Fantasy VI had something that another game should really try. So, Zach, are you going to flip?
I think you're right about Final Fantasy VI having an absolutely terrible opening. I will stand by my statement of I think the ambition wins on this one.
All right, then. Final Fantasy VI will go in at number 11, below Fire Emblem and above Super Mario Bros. 3.
I mean, to be fair, if you told me I had to sit there and play these games for eternity, I would probably be okay with either of them.
I think I might be okay with them both as well.
I would actually choose 6 under those circumstances just because a lot more replayability there.
Provided somebody gave me a guide.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Although if I had to play it forever,
you'd probably figure it out.
Yeah. All right, Zach, what are we going to play next week?
All right, I think we're going to play another grand classic on the Super Nintendo. Is it on the Super Nintendo?
I don't know. I don't know what it is.
NES.
The Super Nintendo NES.
Yeah, just the NES. This game was recently added to the Wii U Virtual Console. We are going to play The Adventures of Bayou Billy.
Oh, actually...
What?
That game's terrible, huh?
I've never even heard
of
this.
That's the first game the Spoony One ever reviewed.
It's definitely just Crocodile Dundee based on the cover art.
next time on Last Time, I can't think of any Spoony jokes, so Samurai Zombie Nation.
This has been a production of Last Time on Video Games, copyright 2016. All the video games and other media mentioned within are copyright their respective owners. Past episodes and other information can be found at www.lasttimeonvideogames.com. If you'd like to contact us, you can reach us by email at ltovg@lasttimeonvideogames.com. We're also on iTunes and would really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star review. Podcast over. You have to go to the start screen and load your last save again.